In late October 2012, Hurricane Sandy stormed its way up from the Bahamas along the east coast of the United States. Anyone live on the east coast in 2012 for that storm? It would be the seventh most damaging storm in U.S. history, a Category 3 hurricane. Winds at their heights were 115 miles an hour. 254 people would die in the storm and its aftermath. And my family at the time was living in northern New Jersey. Thanks to modern meteorology, we knew the storm was coming in advance. So we filled our car with gas, which was good because many gas stations lost power or were on roads that were blocked, and so getting gas became a struggle. We gathered supplies, and we looked at the layout of our house. Given the trees that were surrounding our home, we decided that the safest place for us to sleep the night of the storm was in our living room. The two big trees that were in the front yard might crash through, but we figured they would hit the upper floor and it probably wouldn't crush the main floor of the house. If we stayed in the basement, we thought there was a chance we could get trapped there. We hovered near the back and the side of the living room because along our driveway on the left side of the house, there were a whole bunch of trees, smaller trees, that had grown up more quickly over time, some variety of tree whose trunk didn't get very large, even though they were probably 30 feet tall. We weren't worried about them, but we did want to get as far from that side, too, as we could. The night of the storm, our mattresses were in the living room on the floor, and we had lanterns and water jugs and battery packs all gathered, and we lay huddled and listened to the whipping wind. We could see in the shadows of the streetlights and out the windows the neighboring trees and their branches starting to whip and sway violently. Lila, our daughter, who was 8 at the time, got nervous when the smaller trees whipped around like jump ropes. "Don't be worried," I said, "the wise minister, sage mother. There's a saying in some wisdom traditions that the trees that bend survive the storms. It's the rigid ones that break." That night, all kinds of things cracked and fell. You'd hear it, a loud crack and then a thud as they hit the ground. Against that scary symphony of natural catastrophe, we finally fell asleep. In the morning, we woke as dawn broke to survey the damage. To our surprise, the big trees out front had survived largely intact. A few smaller branches had come down, but mostly they'd held sure and strong. The side of the house was another matter. Those supple trees, the ones with the smaller trunks, the ones the old adage would have predicted would weather the storm best, they had toppled like dominoes. 3 fell right across our front door, blocking us from leaving the house. Others layered over our car and up the back steps to the backyard. They were the carnage of the storm. So much for wisdom traditions. Of course, the saying I'd shared with Lila was meant as both a literal truth and a metaphorical one, right? That those who are rigid in life will break in life's hard times, but those who can bend and move will make it. Like the Olympic skiers that we will be watching in the coming days, bent knees, bouncing and bobbing, to adjust the dips and the rises and the moguls on the mountain and make it down fast and alive. Yet at our house, it was those tough, big, old, unmovable trees out front who were the survivors in our yard, who stood tall and strong and defiant. It was this funny reminder to me of the place for the rigid. Or better put, in a sermon for clarity and toughness and an unwillingness to yield in the world. We know the beauty of those who will not be moved. The ones we sing about in that old African-American spiritual that turned protest anthem, we shall not, we shall not, just like a tree that's planted on the waters, we shall not be moved. We see the images of them, the ones who will not be moved literally, standing as unmovable as they can be against the storms of ice and winter winds, of body and spirit, in the streets these days in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and here in front of our own immigration courts too, to try and guarantee another's rights and ultimately our own too. I mean, if you and I shall not be moved fighting for freedom, we won't get free. If you and I yield while letting them take a neighbor, it's not clear what love thy neighbor means. And we can let the words of Frederick Douglass echo in our ears that the limits of tyrants are prescribed by the endurance of those they oppress. If we yield in some things in life, you and I, who are we after all? Who have we let ourselves become? So moral rigidity, unyielding determination, clarity, and ferocity has its place, my friends, doesn't it? We are grateful it lives in and among us. Sometimes it has been all that has held us together against the hounds of hell. And there is also, across cultures and time, a kind of love that lives in us for something related, a close cousin of moral uprightness that I'll call moral purity for today. Moral purity is similar and not entirely a good thing. It shows up in some religious traditions as literal notions of purity. In traditional Hinduism, there's a notion of purity that traditionally is a practice that's also used to uphold the caste system and reinforce it. In it, high caste Brahmins, the priestly caste especially, need to attend to concerns of maintaining purity. Certain foods are impure. Having people touch your food can make those foods impure. At an event I once attended with an Indian friend and colleague, I offered him one of the cookies that I'd picked up at a buffet on the side. I'd piled them on to share with everyone, and he said no, and then he went and got his own. And when he came back, I asked, "Is mine juta?" Which is the Hindu word for impure and unclean, and he laughed and shrugged. Old habits die hard, even in their diluted form. Your profession, who you touch, who enters your home, one wrong move and you or your house or something can lose its ritual purity in these structures. Certain castes of people, namely the untouchables, do all the work that's considered unclean, handle garbage and dead bodies, even cut hair because hair is a dead material. And when the barber comes to cut your hair to your home, he does so outdoors, so it won't sully the ritual condition of your home. In many other cultures and traditions and religions, a woman's virginity is tied up in language and framing of purity, which is having a resurgence in our world right now. And in certain Jewish communities, women still go to the mikvah or the ritual bath after their menstruation cycle is done to purify themselves so they can enter the synagogue. In many indigenous communities, like the Haida of British Columbia, men purify themselves by fasting and other rituals before war or the hunt to try and ensure success. There seems to be some draw and inclination baked into our human bones for a kind of purity. So let's talk a moment about moral purity in other ways it shows up for us. Moral purity, when it shows up in other contexts around us, for me, often shows up as a feeling that I am free of doubt or blame. It can be the sense of certainty that I know what living with truth, in truth, with a capital T, looks like. It can be a clear sense that you and I are living for a moment, very clearly, unambiguously, on the right side of history. It can feel like this rare sense of being at peace and also morally unassailable, superior. It usually feels really good. That set of feelings can embolden us. They show up everywhere in our world if you start to look for them, right? They can show up in our gossip. They can show up in our social media posts. Oh my goodness, they can show up in our social media posts. Even in our driving. Cut someone off, on purpose or accidentally, and righteousness of biblical proportion can show up in technicolor language. Am I right? With everything else in our lives, so often so ambiguous, so complicated, so messy and broken, it can feel so rare and so comforting not to doubt, to be clear, to feel right, to feel unblemished, even for a moment. And as I said early, moral clarity and a determination to hold those moral lines with backbone is incredibly vital. We need strength and clarity and courage, especially now more than ever. But if there are laws to this universe, and there are, one of those, will you agree, has to be that every strength of character has its corresponding weakness to guard against. Pointed out so beautifully in the stories of Achilles, who was dipped in the river Styx by his nymph mother Thetis, so that her boy would be immortal, above reproach, safe, every superpower to grace his being, but absent in the one place where her fingers held and the flesh remained fallible and mortal. We all have, despite even incredible strength of character, even at our best, some place where that strength has its corresponding weakness. And if that's true, then moral clarity and the courage and righteousness of that can be a strength, and it has a weakness too. What is that weakness? I think it's that because it can feel so good to be righteous, we have to be on guard against getting too identified with being the righteous. That it can feel so good to be righteous, to be right, that we unconsciously don't want that feeling to stop. And when that happens, that we cease to be open to hearing how we might be wrong, or where there's nuance or complexity, or when circumstances have changed and how that change might also affect the choices that we're asked to wade into, or when our actions, as well-intentioned as they are, do unintentional harm, have negative externalities that we did not see coming, which affects now how we should be invited to take responsibility for all we set in motion, but it's so hard to do that sometimes. When our self-identification is among the pure and righteous. In short, perhaps that we who are committed to justice, and we are as a people, forget mercy and humility, though we wrote it on our walls so we would be reminded every single week. Rigidity and righteousness can be our strength, Unitarian Universalists, and they can be our Achilles heel, too. So what does that mean? It doesn't mean that we don't act boldly, we don't try to serve the good and stem the destructive and cruel. It doesn't mean that we feel frozen in our tracks by the realities of this layered world, but it does mean we stay alive to the shades of truth and wisdom, and we stay supple to responding to them, knees bent like the skier on the mountain. So let me give you an example of where we're being begged not to get wed to our purity lately. Over the last 2 weeks in Minneapolis and at a conference of clergy and religious leaders last week in Albuquerque, the organizers at both events who spoke said again and again the following: we must link our arms with those who differ with us, even those who have hurt us in the past, to stem the consolidation of autocratic power that is the biggest danger we face right now. People with a strong sense of moral purity, they warned, would feel that to work with people on the other side of some very important moral issues that we have given our lives to serve and defend, people with whom we differ in very important ways, might feel sullied or resistant to this connection, to this linking of arms. But, they warned, that might ultimately serve evil more than good in this moment. Some truth gets served in some moments by messiness. Some purity is an illusion or a delusion. It's a good reminder of so much, of the danger of binaries, right, of good and bad, especially when it comes to people, where to deny another's goodness stokes the fire often of demonization, and that can also feed that wonderful thing called confirmation bias, where we see only what affirms what we've already decided is true, and that almost inevitably leads to or tempts us to evil done in the name of good toward those people. We're being asked to tear down binaries as much as we can and reach for other hands, though we think them unclean. In our moral lives, it is a challenge to stay fierce and open. Unmovable when we need to be in a storm, but with our roots underground, held by so much that we have to acknowledge is the messy interdependence of us all. And to know and remind ourselves, even though it feels good, even though it fuels lives of boldness, that moral purity is an illusion. You cannot walk in this world and be free of secondary effects you did not attend at the very least, or error of judgment, as well inclined as our hearts and minds are. So I've been sitting with that invitation lately, that challenge. And it reminded me of that storm that hit New Jersey in 2012. And it reminded me that at the time Hurricane Sandy landed, we in the United States, late October of 2012, were also preparing for an election. Maplewood, New Jersey, where I lived at the time, was and is one of the most liberal communities in America. I don't know where we got the data, but we regularly said we had the highest percentage of same-sex couple households anywhere outside of New York City. And our sister town, South Orange, was historically a town that had welcomed Jews and Black families when they weren't welcomed elsewhere. So we were fiercely, proudly, self-righteously liberal. And Barack Obama was running for office pitted against Mitt Romney. Our dukes were up. Our spines were tingling. Day 8 after the storm was the eve of the election. It was also the 8th day that I had no power in my house because 24 power lines had been taken down from the transformer down the many roads that would take it to the power to my house. So it was taking some time and I was exhausted. I'd been rationing my limited gas to drive to church in another town to recharge my phone and check in on older and isolated parishioners. Some of the staff was actively decompensating. Our refrigerator was out, so it was hard to make meals. We had no heat, and it was getting cold at night. And I stood that morning in my bathrobe at the end of my driveway to put my kid in a makeshift carpool to take her to school that had finally opened again. And after I put her in the car, I just stood there and cried because I was done. And in that moment, like a scene out of a Hollywood movie, two big, shiny, white electrical trucks with cherry pickers went by on my street. They saw me, what a sight I must have been, standing there in my bathrobe crying, and one guy stuck his head out of the window and waved and honked, and I waved and smiled back. And I saw something written on both trucks, like in black electrical tape, kind of roughly spelled out. And it was something like Texas to the rescue or Houston is here. And I really lost it. Because I am on the southern side, a daughter of Texas. And that felt reassuring to have people like my uncles and my grandfather showing up to take care, and also the fact that the conservative cavalry had ridden 2,500 miles full time to rescue the most liberal town in New Jersey on the night of a contentious election. Think about that. And righteousness drained from my feet, standing right there beside the two old trees that had survived the storm by being rigid and firm. We need to be fierce and strong and clear in our moral lives to weather some of the storms that we are in the midst of right now, and we need to remember, to stay humble and open and listening and reaching for deeper connections across all that would divide us. And some place in that mix is the way through, I think, I hope, I believe, the way through with integrity and love and our limbs mostly intact. So may we be, so may it be. Amen and amen.
We have a lot of technology in our world. We have our phones, we have our computers, we have our TVs, we have our microphones, we have our cars even. Technology surrounds us all the time. But there's a technology that we have had since the beginning of human existence, a spiritual technology, something that is grounded within us, that calls us to something greater. One of the gifts I received when going to Minneapolis was to be amongst colleagues. And when I was amongst them, I learned tools that are useful during these times of unrest and uncertainty. And Reverend K.P. Hong at Unity Unitarian in St. Paul, Minnesota, taught us one of these spiritual technologies during a vigil. And I want to share that with you today. The ideas and concepts are Reverend K.P. Hong's. I've just put my own words to it to kind of be able to teach you. So know that his original ideas and concepts are embedded in this. First of all, how many of us feel activated and anxious and nervous right now? Yep, sometimes our technologies do that to us, right? What helps us during these times is to find a place that grounds us, that brings us back to ourselves, right? Now, if we did that with our mind speaks the language of time. What did I do yesterday? What's happening now? What's going on tomorrow? Not necessarily a place of groundedness, right? So to find a place of groundedness, we need to go to the body, which orients itself in the language of space. I am here, you are there, we are in this space together. Take a moment and just look around. Look around at the people around you, look at the space, the lights, the shadows. Just look around and orient yourself in that space. Do you feel a shift in your body when you do that? Now I want you to scan your body and find that place of groundedness within yourself. It could be your heart. It could be your stomach. It could be your feet on the ground. It could be your breath. Find where it is that you are grounded within your body. Locate it and rest in it for a moment. Know you are held in this space. You are loved in this space. You are worthy in this space. Now take yourself out of that and look around again once more in the space that you are occupying. Look at the people. And then see if you can bring yourself back to that space within you, that place of groundedness, that place of core being, that anchor. The next step is a bit of a challenge. I want you to find that place within your body that's activated, that's nervous, that's anxious. It could be, again, your heart, it could be your stomach, it could be your mind that's going all these different ways. Touch it for just 5 seconds. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Now come back to that place of groundedness, back to that place of core being, back to that place of loving, of sacredness. Now let's picture a pendulum where we're going to swing back and forth between that place of activation and that place of groundedness. So let's swing towards that place of activation, touch it, maybe a little bit longer. Stay with it if you can. If it's hard, go back to your place of groundedness. Let it hear the little story it might be telling you that's activating you. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Come back to that place of groundedness, that place of core being, that place of anchor, a place of confidence, a place of courage. Let's swing one more time to that place of activation. And I want you to take that groundedness, that confidence, that place that you have within you that is solid and that's core to your being. Take it with you when you go to that place of activation. Maybe have it help you open up your heart and curiosity a little bit. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Come back to groundedness, to core of being, to a place of love. This is a spiritual technology we carry with us wherever we go. We can use it when we're activated, when we're anxious, when we're uncertain, when our mind is racing, our heart is beating. We have that core place of being all the time. May you carry it with you, as well as other spiritual technologies, into your days ahead.